Deutsche Welle, Living Planet. This week on Living Planet, the European Union renews its commitments on carbon trading.
That's exactly what the Parliament's committee voted on, is basically a decision to put the European carbon market in an ambulance, but it still needs to arrive at the hospital in order to receive further treatment.
We chat with the director of the World Vegetable Center.
Then you can grow in pots on your roof, your veranda, in shanty towns, people growing vegetable gardens in sacks, a whole range of different things. As long as you're inventive, you can grow vegetables.
And we plunge into the sewers beneath a German city where new innovations in water management are being tested.
They want to make these methods energy efficient, inexpensive, and adaptable to different climates. If they are successful, they will boost water safety in even the poorest regions on Earth.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. Carbon dioxide, CO2. What do we actually know about it? We hear about it all the time. Well, this inorganic chemical compound is two molecules of oxygen bonded to a lonely molecule of carbon. It's produced through combustion, the decomposition of organic materials, and you produce it every time you breathe out. Now, in the natural balance of things, carbon dioxide in the environment is kept stable by plants which absorb it for photosynthesis. But we've been hard at work in our factories since the start of the 20th century. We've been burning fossil fuels like coal and oil. We've cut down and burnt our trees, and these activities have released carbon dioxide into the atmosphere much faster than the plants and oceans can absorb it. And while it is tasteless and odorless, this humble gas is not harmless. It traps heat, which is why it's called a greenhouse gas, and too much of it means that things down here are getting hotter. Well, here in Europe, they've come up with an economic solution, emissions trading. And the idea is that the government agencies set limits or caps on pollutants like CO2, and if a company exceeds the limit that they produce, they can buy emissions credits. It's been a long, hard road. The EU has pledged to drop its greenhouse gas emissions by 20%, and the European Trading Scheme, or ETS, is considered their best tool for getting there. There's a roadblock, though. The EU is in a financial crisis, and that's almost shattered the carbon market. But the EU isn't giving up. Lawmakers at the European Parliament this week decided that they were going to vote and save the emissions trading scheme. Nina Haase and Lucia Weiss were there, and they have this report from Brussels.
27 dafür. Wer ist dafür? Haben alle abgestimmt. Abstimmung ist geschlossen. So angenommen.
The European Parliament in Brussels voted yes to amending the emissions trading scheme earlier this week. Brussels is starting to fix the problems of one of its most important mechanisms in the fight against climate change. The vote in the committee is a positive result, but it's only the first step, warns the chair of the committee, Matthias Grote.
We have to start now a debate in the European Parliament about the future of the emission trading system. What do we want with the emission trading system in the next years, in the next decade, after 2020? And we need for these things time, and backloading is only buying time.
Backloading means reducing the number of CO2 certificates in the carbon trading market by holding back about 900 million of them. That's what the committee has said yes to. It's an emergency measure which would temporarily reduce supply. And that's urgently needed if the EU wants to keep its trading scheme running, says Sam van den Plas. He's a climate policy officer with environmental organization WWF.
And that's exactly what the Parliament's committee voted on, is basically a decision to put the European carbon market in an ambulance, but it still needs to arrive at the hospital in order to receive further treatment.
The European Trading System, or ETS, is the main mechanism to meet the EU's 2020 target. EU members have agreed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% in comparison to the levels emitted in the year 1990. Under the ETS scheme, companies buy and sell permits to emit carbon dioxide. If they emit less than their permits allow, they can sell the excess for a profit. But there is a problem. The permits are currently too cheap. The economic downturn in Europe has seen prices drop. Today, any European company can blow 1 million tonnes of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere for a mere 4 euros. In other words, for the price of a sandwich.
What has happened in between is that we saw an economic downturn, which led to a decrease of emissions by the industrial sectors that are covered by Europe's carbon market. But in return, the number of emission allowances that were available on this carbon market has not decreased.
The Environment Committee in the European Parliament has already said yes to reducing supply on the market. But other European institutions and the member states themselves will now have to follow suit. But some governments are hesitant, including Germany. That's surprising, says Bas Eickhout from the Dutch Green Party, considering that Germany has decided to phase out nuclear energy and make renewables a significant part of the country's energy mix. This transition is what Germans call the Energiewende.
And I don't understand why Germany is not moving. It's really very strange, because Germany needs this decision for their own Energiewende. So the lower the carbon price, the more expensive the Energiewende in Germany. So I really don't understand why Germany is so slow.
Germany has a strong business lobby, and many companies there say the ETS is not necessary. They invest in green energy, whether prices on the carbon trading market are high or low. But the business sector's goodwill has not proven enough to meet the EU's emission reduction targets. 11,000 companies are currently responsible for half the EU's greenhouse gas emissions. And the ETS was set up to give them an incentive to move away from fossil fuels and invest in green technologies instead. But the flaws in the scheme have meant that the ETS has lost credibility, says Sarah Diblock from the International Emission Trading Association. Her group represents more than 150 of the world's biggest firms, including energy giants Vattenfall and Gazprom.
We don't have as much clarity than what we had expected, and this uncertainty and unpredictability is very harmful for those who are operating in the market.
Bas Eickhout from the Green Party says the EU has to go even further. Europe ought to show leadership in the fight against climate change again. That, he argues, would benefit both the environment and the economy.
We need a 2030 package. Pushing for renewables, pushing for energy efficiency, and pushing for a more ambitious climate target. That will stimulate the innovative industry, and that is exactly the industry we need in Europe, because on many other fronts it's difficult to outcompete China. But on innovation we are still in the lead, but therefore we need an ambitious climate package.
At the end of the day, says WWF's Sam van den Plas, there's simply no alternative.
Thinking that this problem is going away or that we can put it off the policy agenda indefinitely is plainly naive and stupid. We risk to drive humanity off the cliff, and we need to take responsibility to act on the basis of the scientific information that we have.
Nina Hase, DW Brussels.
Thank you to our Brussels studio for that report. All over the world, new innovations are helping farmers maximize water usage and strengthen food security. The real challenge in fighting hunger isn't just getting enough food, it's also getting the right kind of food. Well, earlier this week, I was joined in studio by the host of DW's development show World in Progress. That's Anka Raspa. We spoke to the head of the World Vegetable Center, Dr. Dino Keating. He told us about the very important role vegetables have to play in fighting world hunger and improving global health.
Man cannot live by bread alone, nor can they live with rice alone. You absolutely have to have these vital minerals and nutrients and vitamins in order to remain healthy. So for much of sub-Saharan Africa, the problem of malnutrition is vitamin A deficiency, iron deficiency, zinc deficiency, and much of the supply of these things comes through your fruit and vegetables. If you don't eat them, you will be unwell.
You actually have an interesting project that encourages people to grow those kinds of vegetables themselves. This is the Small Garden or Community Gardens Project. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
We believe that one of the best ways to combat both malnutrition and the alleviation of poverty is to get people to grow their own vegetables in their own gardens. This doesn't require a huge amount of land. In fact, if you have a 6 by 6 meter plot of vegetables, you can feed a family of four with pretty well all of the vitamin and mineral nutrition you require over a year. There is an important element of social cohesion, of other social type benefits that come with growing gardens, that people who grow them in communities feel supportive, valued.
So with these home gardens and community gardens, I think you've distributed about 25,000 seed packages, if that's correct. How many people could possibly be fed through these gardens?
Well, of course, everybody that wishes to have a vegetable garden, as long as they have access to land, potentially can have one. I mean, vegetable seed is a very cheap input. Yes, you probably do need some additional inputs, potentially some manure, some fertilizer, some insecticides if that's a problem. But if you have absolutely no money, you can usually buy one packet of tomato seed, that's 50 US cents. And it's a good investment then under those circumstances. Then you can grow in pots on your roof, your veranda, wherever. We see in shanty towns people growing vegetable gardens in sacks, a whole range of different things. So as long as you're inventive, you can grow vegetables.
Can you tell me about your work to produce vegetables that aren't as sensitive to salt, drought, or high temperatures?
Right. Yes, we are indeed facing the issue of temperature increases, more unpredictable rainfall amounts, which causes flooding, which is a major problem for vegetables. So in the case of salinity, we're working with screening different vegetables for their response to salt. And we have now eggplants and tomatoes that appear to be more salt tolerant than some of the others. In terms of flooding, we found that if you can graft eggplant rootstocks onto tomato scions, tomato tops, you can make them much more resistant to soil-borne diseases and to issues of excess water, and can produce a crop perfectly happily. We're also studying heat tolerance in sweet pepper, etc.
I read about that, actually, that you, last October, I think you released a study where you talked about the focus on hot air and the focus on air in general would be part of your strategy. Why is that?
In the case of our headquarters in Taiwan, which appear to have a very rapid rate of increase in terms of air temperature of around 4 degrees centigrade per 100 years, that means that over the next 25 years, we have to build in an additional 1 degree centigrade heat tolerance for our breeding material. And you need to know that at the beginning of the breeding program, so you pick the right parents that have heat tolerance, rather than picking ones that you might pick for yield benefits or for disease resistance. Those things are obviously important too, but to make sure that those genes for heat tolerance are in there right at the beginning.
I have a question about the quality of the vegetables that are available on world markets. There have been some reports that the quality or the mineral content in vegetables that are available has degraded in recent years. Is there anything to that report?
Yes, there is literature to suggest that the nutrient density of vegetables in the 1920s and 30s in Europe and North America were higher than they are today.
Why is that?
Well, the reason for that is that breeders, particularly for hybrid vegetable seed, are interested in the supermarket. So that means they're looking for shelf life, appearance, colour, consistency of shape, these sorts of things, whereas they have not been paying any attention to nutrient density. Whereas in the indigenous vegetables, they are all, in fact, very nutrient dense pretty well. And we have plenty of good vegetables around. We just have to make sure that we don't only over-concentrate our efforts on the three or four major ones worldwide.
And what kind of seeds do you distribute?
We particularly pick for the hardy, fast-growing vegetables with a mixture of different nutrient availabilities, some protein, some vitamins, some minerals, etc., and which don't require either massive inputs or huge knowledge to grow properly. So, you know, they're fairly robust and self-contained. We do give it with information sheets that are in cartoon form or in local languages. But seeing is believing, I have to say, when it comes to agriculture.
That also seems to be the case in the case of these school gardens, which are also part of what you're promoting. When kids see how something is grown, do they start to eat the spinach or broccoli they might detest otherwise?
Well, I don't think children naturally detest vegetables. Once they've grown their own, it's in the living laboratory. It's a much more exciting prospect for them to actually consume those vegetables. And the nice thing is that they take the seed home and then they persuade their parents to grow them and that type of thing. So there is a natural extension from the school garden to the much greater, wider community.
We have a last question for you. Do you have a favorite vegetable species that is tasty, easy to grow, and also very nutritious?
Okay, I will go for Malabar spinach. It's an indigenous vegetable of South Asia, slightly mucilaginous, but it makes a really good spinach to go with curry. It's highly nutritious, both in terms of vitamin and mineral content. It's easy to grow. Insects don't bother it to any great extent, and it's one of these vegetables we usually put into the disaster recovery packs because we wouldn't want people to grow things that I don't like.
Malabar spinach it is then. Dr. Dino Keating is the Director General of the World Vegetable Center. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's been my pleasure, and I have a very small donation to give to Deutsche Welle here to remind you that vegetables are important for your diet as well. Thank you very much.
Oh, we're going to have
indeed.
A Deutsche Welle garden now, I think.
Can you tell us what's in there?
You can find an eggplant, pepper and a tomato, but please don't eat it because, in fact, they are made for soaps.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I'd be happy to come back.
Solar power incentive programs have created a boom in renewable energy technology across Europe and North America. And this is an important step towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions produced by skyscrapers, apartment buildings, and the office blocks we use every day. But while sticking solar panels on the roof and improving insulation on windows is a really good step in the right direction, experts say we need new, innovative building techniques and technology. The global solar panel market has also been flooded with hardware from China. They are powerful global competitors. But European designers believe they can up their marketability by creating innovative systems that are also pleasing to the eye. Megan Williams has this report.
Inside this light-filled atrium of a community hall of Bressanone, a town nestled in the Italian Dolomites, alternative energy experts are milling about, displaying technological breakthroughs and showcasing their latest work. Since incentives to convert buildings to alternative energy were implemented throughout Europe, Australia, and now in North America, millions of rooftops across the world shimmer with blue-black solar panels. It's a first and important step towards reducing the enormous greenhouse emissions produced by buildings. But as the experts here make clear, sticking solar panels on a roof or better insulating windows are steps in the right direction, but hardly the end solution.
You know, over the years, buildings, the issue with them is that we've been building them in pieces.
Engineer Livio Nichilo is just one of the young entrepreneurs here. At 32, he heads up the Canadian company Internat Energy Solutions. That works to make buildings more energy efficient, comfortable, and attractive. He says reducing greenhouse emissions in buildings involves using renewable forms of energy, like solar and wind, but also increasing the efficiency of buildings, doing things like reducing heating in higher floors of tall buildings, where heat naturally rises, or making better building skins or envelopes, the outside shell of a building.
The reality is that a building, actually, to function properly, all of these pieces need to be working together.
Nichilo's firm recently completed a building shell for the N-Wave Theatre in Toronto with dramatic blue sea wave-shaped solar glazing designed by glass artist Sarah Hall. The glazing is stunning to look at, but it also has an integrated heat mirror that produces energy that's channeled into the theatre for lighting purposes.
It's the first combination of photovoltaic with artwork with the heat mirror technology in the world.
Peter Irk is another energy expert looking for new approaches to integrating design and aesthetics into energy-producing building shells.
Organic means it's carbon-based materials.
Irk is the head of organic photovoltaic research at BASF Research in Germany. Together with the company Heliotech, he's developing organic solar cells. Normally, solar cells are made of silicon. Irk's products, though, use colored dyes with carbon-based semiconductor properties that absorb the light and convert it into electrical power. Their advantage? They're light, so they can easily sit atop buildings. They're flexible, meaning they can be rolled up for easy transportation. And they're colored. The energy-producing films can be slid between window panes to produce a kind of geometric stained glass effect. Because they're colored, though, they don't produce as much energy as the normal blue-black silicon solar panels do. But, Irk says, it's a worthwhile price to pay for the aesthetic gain.
I cannot imagine walking around in the city of the future and all the walls are just black. So this would be a very, very depressing scenario for me.
28-year-old Italian Ilaria Iriolfo is a PhD student in architecture and building design at the Politecnico of Madrid and part of a Spanish team that uses water inside windows to control indoor temperatures.
So it consists in a window with the spaces between is one with water and the other with air.
It's called the active glazing system, and it consists of three window panes with water between the interior and middle pane and air between the middle and exterior ones. In the summer, the water between the panes absorbs the heat and is then cooled in a closed-circuit pipe. Through a heat interchanger, its warmth heats up the water in a separate pipe that can be channeled into a backyard pool or for other use. In the winter, the sun-heated water inside the panel can be used to directly heat the room.
You don't see the water because the two glasses appear totally transparent, and you don't see also the movement of this water, but you can feel it when you are in the space because you feel the temperature and the comfort. It's good. So I think it's an innovation.
Ariolfo says the technology is still being perfected, but already five dwellings in Spain use the water and window panes to control temperatures. Other concepts presented in Bresinone are still in the experimental stage. The question here on everyone's lips is always about getting enough funding to get the projects up and running. One thing is for sure, though, the technology for creating energy-efficient and aesthetically pleasing buildings is already here. Megan Williams, DW, Bresinone, Italy.
Our last piece in today's show is about the vast water and sewage systems that run underneath many cities and towns around the world. Now, no one likes to think about the sludge and waste festering in the gutter, I know, but wastewater contains everything from dish soap and shower gel to excrement and paint thinner, and cleaning it so it can be used again is a monster task. Our correspondent, Camille Grayson, decided to find out just how it's done, and she discovered that the sewage plant in the German town where she lives is actually world-class, and they're helping governments around the world redesign their own sewage systems.
Have you ever wondered where the water from your sink or your toilet goes? Here, in the German city of Bonn, the water travels through pipes in the walls of the house and out into the sewer lines underneath the streets. Bonn's wastewater travels through a sewer network that is about 950 kilometers long. After its long journey, it arrives at the city's sewage treatment plant, which is composed of a series of buildings, each dedicated to a separate step in the water purification process. Richard Esser is the manager here. He leads me on a tour of the sewage treatment plant. He explains that the technology here is some of the most advanced in the world. In fact, people travel to the Bonn site from Russia, China, and other countries to learn about German innovations in water processing.
It is certainly expensive to build this kind of facility, but many visitors who come from different countries to observe what we are doing here consider this a cutting-edge facility.
Over the last decade, Germany has not only invested in domestic production of sewage technology, it has also become an exporter of sewage systems. According to a recent study from the European Commission, Germany is the largest EU exporter of water technologies. And the German Engineering Federation reports that Germany exported nearly 800 million euros worth of water technology and wastewater technology in 2011. But a lot of this technology has been tailored to Germany's climate, water quality, and water management policies. Dr. Harold Horn from the Karlsruhe Institute for Technology is a specialist in water processing techniques. He says, adapting the technology to different climates and making it compatible with local systems can be difficult. And even if the technology works, adapting to underfunded sewage systems is a challenge for German suppliers of wastewater technology.
Generally speaking, Asia, especially China, they have already installed the sewer systems and collect the wastewater so that it can be transported to a central treatment unit. China is one of the largest countries where we at this time develop wastewater treatment technology, has a quite similar system compared to Europe or compared to Germany. On the other hand, in Africa, if you do not have the sewer systems, which is quite expensive, you have to look for decentralized systems or where you have very simple systems like pit latrines. So that is, compared to the European standard, a very low technology.
Horn's team is researching different types of treatment and experimenting with the gas that is given off by water which contains human waste.
In biological wastewater treatment, we use two types of bacteria. One we call aerobic, they need oxygen, so that we have to aerate the wastewater with air. The other system is dealing with anaerobic bacteria, where we have no oxygen, no air, and the microorganisms start to produce biogas, methane, which then, if it's collected properly, can be used for production of electrical energy or which can be used for heating.
Modern-day wastewater innovations in Germany were developed in the late 20th century. Now, it's a question of improving existing treatment methods. Horn's team is trying to fine-tune both the aerobic and anaerobic methods. They want to make these methods energy efficient, inexpensive, and adaptable to different climates. If they are successful, they will boost water safety in even the poorest regions on Earth.
The problem is, if you use the anaerobic technology, it's working very well at 25 or 30 degrees Celsius, but not very properly at 15 degrees. So in countries with warm climate, where the wastewater temperature might be above 20 degrees Celsius, this anaerobic technology is a very good idea to convert the carbon, which is in wastewater, to biogas. This technology will not work in colder climates where the wastewater temperature is below 20 or only 15 degrees Celsius.
Upgrading a city's sewage system requires more than the purchase of a modern sewage facility. The city's infrastructure needs to be improved in order to collect wastewater. Horn explains that in Germany and other European countries, most of the money spent on wastewater treatment is invested in designing and building systems for wastewater collection.
First is you have to collect the wastewater and try to get rid of it as quick as possible, because it's a hygienic problem. So you do not want to have the pathogens in this urban areas, because the risk of infection is quite high. So the collection system, the sewers, are of high importance after collection, and you can then set up your wastewater treatment plant.
With many developing nations swiftly urbanizing, poorly managed wastewater presents a serious health threat. But new challenges create new opportunities, and aside from improving urban health, water technology experts in Germany are counting on continued success in global markets.
Thank you to Camille Grayson for that report. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. In the meantime, you can also visit us online at dw.de/environment. I'm your host, Saroja Coelho. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again soon.
Sugar, I call my baby my sugar. I never maybe my sugar. That sugar baby of mine, he's special ration for me. He never asks for my money. All that I give him is honey, and that he can spend any time. I'd make a million trips to his lips if I were a bee, because he's sweeter than chocolate candy.